The more I studied the science, the more I realised it's all about the process, Doug. So when you talk about small goods, you talk about process. Ingredients is one thing, but process is everything. And that's something that I've realised over the years.
This is the Australian Butchers Guild Podcast, brought to you by Meat and Livestock Australia, the podcast for passionate butchers.
G'day butchers, I'm Doug Piper. Welcome to the Australian Butchers Guild Podcast. I hope you've been enjoying the podcast sessions we've been running over the past few months, and I'm surprised where all of our listeners are coming from. You know, we've got listeners from all around the country, all around the world actually, 50 different countries all up. We've got them coming in from the UK, US, Ireland, our Kiwi mates across the ditch in New Zealand, Canada, throughout Asia, and my favourite holiday place in Thailand. And also a big shout out to those few butchers listening to us in Ukraine. We wish you all the best and we're thinking of you. And now for a bit of an industry update, here's Brett Thomas.
Hi, it's Brett Thomas with an Around the Grounds update for the Australian Butchers Guild. Over the past few years, there's been a real resurgence in the craft of butchery all around the world. So if you're looking at renovating your shops and seeking ideas, you don't have to go too far to get some inspiration. From shop designs right down to shop uniforms that are different from the traditional white shirt and striped aprons that were worn years ago. The internet and butchery social pages have a huge amount of imagery and ideas for you to find that inspiration. For instance, more butchers are opting for an industrial look, using timber or stamped metal sheeting and exposed pipework in the front of their shops. Bain-Marie food warmers and combi ovens are becoming more popular in stores, providing snacks, lunches and complete dinners for shoppers to pick up, ready to eat on their way home. The traditional butcher uniforms are being replaced with handcrafted leather aprons or aprons made from thicker, fancy fabrics, complete with leather straps and belts. Cool collared shirts have replaced the old white dentist coats, and not forgetting the old peak cap is making a comeback. Overall, exciting changes are happening in the trade, with a lot of butchers seeing the benefits of these small changes, making shopping at the butchers more of an enjoyable experience rather than a chore. That's the Around the Grounds update for now. Make sure you check back next episode for more industry news and information. Back to you, Doug.
One of the more enjoyable parts of my work is looking for ways to use beef and lamb in everyday products. You know I love low and slow cooking, making sausages and experimenting with small goods, and looking for opportunities to incorporate beef and lamb as an alternative to chicken and pork, so I'm on the lookout for something new. So I thought I'd give my old mate Andrew Morabito a call to share some of his knowledge around small goods with us. Andrew's one of the great team of butchers who are training the next generation of butchers at Granville's TAFE in Sydney's West. The Meat and Allied Trade section cater for many aspects of the trade, from training apprentice butchers, they've got some short introductory butchery classes for foodies and chefs, and also small goods making. They are about to start their beef and beer classes. How good's that? Beef and beer classes. That's where you learn about low and slow barbecuing and brewing beer. You know, that's a marriage made in heaven. Andrew is keeping the dying craft of charcuterie alive. He's always been keen to share his knowledge with anyone who is eager to listen and learn. So I thought it was time to have a chin wag with him. G'day, Andrew.
G'day, Doug. How you going, mate?
Going great, thanks, buddy. How about you? I see you working in a shop today.
So we have the Easter break and just helping a friend out in a butcher shop because it's a busy time of the year and I like to keep my hand in as well.
As I mentioned earlier in the piece before we introduced you, you're a TAFE teacher at Granville TAFE with Ben Barrow, who we interviewed earlier in the quite early on the episodes actually. Mm-hmm. You're the small goodsman there too.
Yeah, so I mean, I've been a butcher for a long, long time now, but started my trade probably back in 89.
You're only young, mate.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the greys don't say that, but anyhow. Yeah, so I've been teaching at Granville TAFE College now for probably, I started there in 2008.
Okay.
So it's probably my 14th year that I've been there now. So yeah, time flies.
Wow, it's about the same amount of time I've been with MLA.
Wow, there you go. I mean, I grew up on a farm, Doug, so for me, it was a natural progression to do something in food. Grew up on a farm out of Bringelly. I'm not sure if you know where that is, out of the foot of the Blue Mountains.
Yep.
Yeah, we had about 50 acres out there, cattle, lamb, goats, chickens, pigs, everything.
You had the whole lot, the mixed bag.
Yeah, a whole lot. And my old man was very, very passionate about animal welfare. That was one of the big things with Dad, about how the animals were treated. So we weren't allowed to have any pets. Okay, so our pets were for food, mate.
Yes, don't go naming the animals because you won't like eating Lucy.
No, that's exactly right, yeah. So, I mean, I suppose I got really passionate about preserving foods back at an early age when we used to preserve everything. So we'd make our own salamis and prosciutto and, you know, all the traditional Italian small goods, and mm-hmm. our freezer was always full of fresh beef and lamb and goat all the time. We always had it there in the freezer. So then it went from there to school and then straight into a butcher shop.
Yeah, right, okay. So what age did you start butchering?
I think I started when I was about 17.
Okay, you're a latecomer, mate.
I was a latecomer back then, because most butchers started when they were 14 or 15 years old.
Exactly.
Yeah, I started in 1989 and I left school in 1987. So there was a couple of years when I was doing other jobs. I think I tried my hand at carpentry and then did a bit of concreting and a few other little bits and pieces, but it always came back to food. It always comes back to my passion.
Was it you that was telling me your dad was a concreter, a bricklayer or something? Was that you?
Dad's a concreter, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Most of the Italians, mate, we came, we saw, we concreted.
love it.
Yeah, so I mean, I worked in, probably started my career in a traditional Italian butcher shop, and most of my apprenticeship was probably spent preparing meat for customers who were going to go on and make their own small goods out of it.
Okay.
So for me, it was always about asking questions to the customers come in. What are you going to do with this and what are you going to do with that?
Mm-hmm.
So after finishing my apprenticeship, the butchers I worked for were mostly from a European background, whether they were Croatian or Polish or Italian or French, and each culture, that they all did all their own small goods making.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably where I picked up a lot of the fascination that I have for small goods.
Right.
So after many, many years of working in those shops and learning all the traditional ways how they used to make their small goods, I was always fascinated by the science behind it. The more I studied the science, the more I realized it's all about the process, Doug. So when you talk about small goods, we talk about process.
Mm-hmm.
And ingredients is one thing, but process is everything. And that's something that I realized over the years. So a lot of the older guys would make their small goods in traditional ways because it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they were taught, but they never questioned why. I was always the kid that used to say, yeah, but why? And it was always, just shut up and do it. And I probably think that's why before I started teaching, it really fascinated me and sort of got me into the teaching side of it, because I got to learn about all the different ingredients that they were using and why they used them.
When you mention process, that can mean a few different things. How are you using that? What context are you using that in? So is that the process of doing each individual step?
Well, yes, it's about most small goods producers that I know are slightly OCD, which is not a bad thing in the small goods industry.
Yep.
And the reason I say it is because most of the really good small goods manufacturers, especially the smaller ones that I go and see, they're very pedantic about ingredients and process. And that's replicated right across the small goods industry. I see that in every single place I go to, they're the same. Okay. A lot of the older guys would do things because they would only do it when the moon was full, okay? And a lot of that turned out to be a lot of baloney as far as I was concerned, but that's how they did it.
Yeah.
And it always worked, you know? So process would be about making sure that every time they made that product, it was made in exactly the same way, exactly the same time of the year. They would get the salt from the same mountain or the same sea salt that they would use, and et cetera, et cetera.
So that was it, Salami Week. We're about to enter that, aren't we?
We're getting very close, mate. We are getting very close to salami season, we call that.
Yep.
It's like footy season, mate, but for small goods makers.
So that, again, is what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's purely because it's traditional.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And also, too, because traditionally they would cure their salamis in the garage or in the shed, or somewhere where it was clean,
yep,
but constant temperature. And you need to be able to cure things outside of it, a controlled environment. You need consistency. So you need the right temperature, you need the right humidity.
Yeah, right.
I mean, we talk about some of the old ways. I mean, I look at things like nitrites and nitrates and you know, and you could have a whole podcast just on that.
Mm.
But a lot of the older people say, no, never used to use nitrates in my salamis and never used to use nitrates in my bacon that I used to use. But they would use natural sea salts.
Yeah, okay.
Or they would use the Himalayan rock salt, which contains sodium nitrate.
I was actually looking at that yesterday. I was looking at the difference between one and two, like, cure one and two, and what they're used for, and I saw a recipe for a beef pepperoni, and it says pink salt.
Yes,
and I'm going, okay, so What does that mean? So, you know, okay, you've got Himalayan pink salt, you've got pink salt anyway, well, whatever it is, and then you've got your cures, one and two.
Yeah. So if they've said pink salt, what they've meant is that would have probably been an American recipe.
Definitely.
And when you look at that, if they say pink salt, they actually colour their nitrite and nitrate with a pink dye, mm-hmm. so that way they can tell the difference between them. We don't do that in Australia, but in America they definitely do.
Right.
Okay, so when they say pink salt, they're probably meaning cure one or cure two. Mm-hmm. So cure one would be a sodium nitrite, mm-hmm. which you would use in a cooked product.
Right.
Okay, so cure number two would be a combination of sodium nitrite and sodium nitrate,
okay.
which you would use in a dry cured product.
So could I mix pink salt with sodium nitrite with cure number one, I mean?
Well, the pinks, you could, yes, definitely. Mm. The pink salt, if you're meaning the, say, the pink Himalayan salt.
Yep.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, you could mix it, but again, it's because it's a natural salt, there's uncontrolled amounts of trace elements in that salt.
Okay, right.
And this is the difference between, say, when Mum was probably making salamis back in the day and now. I think I got Mum's tested once, and I think there was more nitrite in her salamis than there was in mine. But I couldn't tell her that.
No, okay. No, you get the thong slap across the face, mate. Bang.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Mate, 100%. Yeah. So, I mean, when guys are making small goods in a butcher shop, a lot of people think that you need a special license, okay? Mm-hmm. So depending on the type of small goods you're making, it's already part of your food safety plan. So if you're making cooked small goods, I can almost guarantee you that those cooked small goods are a part of your food safety plan already. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they're the easiest to do because most butchers have already got the equipment, okay, and they don't have to spend too much money or upgrade too much to be able to produce quality artisan small goods. Okay, so uncooked fermented products, different story altogether, Doug.
Yeah, right.
You do require a special license. Okay, and it's much harder to achieve in a traditional butcher shop. And it's more for specialised small goods manufacturers who've got the equipment and the food safety plans to suit what they make. And they'll revolve their businesses around the products they make.
And also in Australia, like because we've got Prime Safe, I think it is, in Victoria, you've got Food Safe in New South Wales and I think Queensland, I'm not too sure what there is in the other couple of states around the place. Or everybody's... I suppose health regulations are all different, but at the end of the day, small goods, like you said, specifically with dry aged small goods, like the naturally cured small goods, that's the one that they've got to be careful of.
Yeah, so there's not a lot of little traditional butcher shops who would ferment products, so dry cured and ferment. They would more sort of smoke and then dry cure, but dry curing smoke products isn't really fermenting. Mm-hmm. It's drying, so it's almost like making jerky or something like that. So that's different to fermenting. So like, say an example of something that a butcher could easily do in a butcher shop where they wouldn't need a lot of equipment would be a Frankfurt. Mm. You do a really good beef Frankfurt and you went and bought a meal. Mm-hmm. Okay, so a Hyman's meal, which is a really good meal, just one of them on the market. Do a nice beef Frankfurt out of it, add your own flavour profile to it, just to, you know, customise it to you so no one else has the same flavour profile you had. It could be anything, could be a bit of cayenne, could be anything. Now, the best result for a Frankfurt would be having a bowl cutter to emulsify it, okay? If you didn't, I actually know a few butchers who are making a really good product with their mincer. So it's quite possible to make a good Frankfurt just using your mincer.
So would they'd need to obviously run it through a fine plate, but would you do that more than, say, three times, something like that? Or
yeah, so you would run it through a coarse plate maybe once or twice and then put the finer plate on and then maybe run it through another two or three times until you got the consistency that you wanted. Mm-hmm. And again, we'll come back to process. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it'd be running it through the coarse plate, putting it back in the freezer for a certain amount of time, bringing it back out again, mixing your ingredients, putting it back in the freezer, back through the mincer, and so on and so on. And that way, if you follow that same process every single time, you would end up with a consistent product. And it might have a little bit of texture to it, but that might be the point of difference between your Frankfurt and the one you buy from the mass-produced guys.
Mm, yeah. Mm. Yeah, we were there at TAFE last week and you were talking about it, and I grabbed a pack of those ones that you made, the beef ones, and they were bloody beautiful, mate. They were I had them, and I think I had the the cheese, the double cheese Kransky. Yeah, mate, yeah. Awesome. Awesome product.
So if you look at that, Doug, I was just, I mean, if you were to cook your Frankfurts, I mean, every butcher knows how to fill out a sausage. Mm. And all you'd have to do is blanch them in water at 75 to 80 degree water for about 20, 25 minutes or until they reached about 68 internal.
Yep.
Shock them in cold water and they'll stay that shape. If you let them air dry, the skin will go all wrinkly and you'll end up with Cabanossi. Okay?
Right.
If you were to fill them out in a red collagen casing, you would have a traditional Frankfurt. If you fill them out into a sheep casing and you smoke them, there's your continental Frankfurt. If you took that same mix and added a little bit of cheese and some chilies and some spices to it, fill it out in a hog casing, you've got cheese Kranskis.
Yeah, right, okay.
So out of one mix, you can make four or five different products.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of butchers who I've visited over the last, say, 12 years, they've got smoke ovens in the shop and they're totally underutilized.
Mm.
Okay, they make hams at Christmas and possibly bacon for the rest of the year.
It's such a missed opportunity, isn't it?
It is. I mean, there are a few guys who are using their oven to its full potential, and some of the products they're making is like using their beef briskets and making ham, beef bacon.
Yep.
They're making lamb bacon. They're making pastrami. You know, they're coming up with a, go on the internet and you find the recipe for Katz's pastrami rub.
Yep.
Okay, and most butchers will sell corned beef, Doug, you know, so it's not a far cry to go from corned beef to pastrami.
No, definitely not. One of the things that we promote beef and lamb, goat and veal at MLA, right? So we've got to focus on that. But one of the things that we have played with in the past, as you know, is the beef ham.
Mm.
And I put a little post out on, you know, on socials and, you know, you get ready for it. You cop a few gooses out there that have, you know, keyboard warriors that have know everything. Yeah. Nobody knows everything, not even you or me, you know, nobody does. But you know, this one of these guys said, oh, it's just corned beef, you know, but it's the process.
It's not corned beef.
Exactly, you know.
It's not corned beef.
Pastrami is not corned beef. Like, you know, beef ham isn't corned beef. It's a different process. You're using a different cure to start with. You're smoking it, and I cook mine. The one that I cooked, the ones that I cook in my smoker at home, are just smoked and cooked at the same time, and it's a completely different texture. You're cooking at a different degree of doneness. I think it's, what, 67 degrees or something like that. That's what I cook it up to. Mate, perfect, you know, and it comes out great.
That's exactly right.
It's having these something different, because that's the main point of difference between a supermarket and a butcher shop.
100%.
Is being able to make something different that's going to keep the customers coming back, keep them interested in coming back, as well as being able to say, this is house made or this is made in the shop. Because those two points of difference are crucial to keeping the customer happy.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the guys that I see, people are coming in and asking for pulled beef, cooked briskets, hot or cold.
Yep.
People are coming in, they're buying pre-cooked ribs where they're smoked and they're cooked, because you can do that in your normal smoke oven, you know?
Yeah.
Have it fully cooked all the way through, vacuum seal them in a cooking bag, and customer just has to put them in a bit of hot water. So heat and eat is one of those things that I think it's a missed opportunity by butchers out there who have a smoke oven.
Yep.
There is some laws, but I mean, when we look at that, and probably something we should talk about, is making sure that once you've established a recipe, that you don't deviate from that recipe.
Mm-hmm.
And more importantly, that the process never changes. Now, you talk about consistency and point of difference. Some guys just go, I'll add a bit of this and add a bit of that. No, it has to be an exact recipe and an exact process. Okay. You also need to follow some rules. Okay. Not set out by me, not set out by you, Doug, set out by New South Wales Food Authority.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And those rules are for cooking and cooling. And they're all outlined in your food safety plan. Those rules aren't something that you have to look up. They're already part of your food safety plan.
Mm.
So if butchers took the time out to read their food safety plan, it's a very outcome-based document.
Right.
So it says, how do I cook something? This is the outcome I have to achieve. This is how you get there. It's a very, very simple thing. And when I say outcome-based, they've set it up that way with their new food safety plan to make it simple. So they're not there to make it hard for them.
No.
But there is rules you have to follow.
Oh, exactly.
We're trying to get more and more guys into the college to do some courses. And we run some nighttime classes there, just short courses. just their tasters more than anything else, but they can take away from those courses as much as possible. We do ham and bacon, salami making classes, sausage making, basic butchery classes. And you'll be keen on this, Doug. As of next semester, we'll be running some low and slow barbecue courses.
Perfect.
Okay. So using the American style barbecues, showing students how to prep and cook.
Right.
And we also, they're like tasters, little short 2-week tasting courses that we do. But we also run a full certificate 3 in small goods manufacturing. Okay. So the full cert 3 is a 2-year course, mm-hmm. and it's the same as your traditional apprenticeship. Okay. So you can either do it as a trainee, and we're also taking non-trainees as well. So we've got a couple of chefs who are doing the course. They're taking the time out to do it in their own time, and it's becoming more and more popular all the time. As you know, Doug, an emerging trend in the industry is the American style low and slow.
Yeah.
Okay, which is rapidly growing in Australia. It's getting bigger and bigger. And a number of butcher shops or their customers are asking for these types of cuts. And I think it's up to us as butchers to make sure that we understand the terminology mm-hmm. for the cuts that they're using. Because as you know, Doug, Ausmeat language isn't the same as what they're talking about on YouTube.
Yeah, exactly.
And social media.
Yep, I know.
So having an understand of the type of briskets that they want for low and slow, the type of beef ribs that they're using for the low and slow cooking, and the cooking techniques. And part of the course and part of what we try to educate the young butchers coming through is to teach them different terminology, teach them the difference between the big briskets, the small ones, and what you can and can't do with them.
Yeah. Now, it's so important to get that part right, because if they don't and they get the wrong part of the brisket, whether they get the navel end or the point end or both ends, you know, the customer's going to go, that was a waste of time. I don't think I'll go back. Not so much not go back, but it didn't work for them.
No.
And so they won't give it another crack. But I was having a discussion, I can't remember who it was, a few weeks ago, about the amount of meat these guys and girls on the weekends cook. Mm. You take a brisket, what's that worth? You get a point end brisket, there's probably $70, $80 in that, depending on the quality of it. If it's a Wagyu one or a grass or whatever it is, then they might grab probably maybe a couple of tomahawks or cattleman cutlets, you know, the ribeye and the bone. There's another $50, $60. So already you're up to nearly $150 just there. And that's what they're doing every weekend, these guys and girls. You know, they're out there. That's a great sale on a Saturday morning.
You're not wrong. I'm serving customers here this morning, and if I'm on the counter serving customers, it's quite funny to work alongside the butchers who they know, but because they know I'm here, a customer will come in and say, how long will I cook this brisket for? And they'll just go, Andrew, come over here. Talk to this customer about cooking this brisket, or cooking, you know, how do you do these short ribs, and
yeah.
how do you get them to the right tenderness? And so it's a conversation that butchers really have to understand if they want to make sales, because there's a lot of money in it.
It's money for jam. It's stuff we're already selling. It's things that some of these cuts we've always thrown into sausages and mincemeat. And now you've got an opportunity to make gold out of it. You know, you can certainly increase the value of the carcass and the back end, like the GP at the end of the week, by using these cuts, cutting them properly and giving that customer the correct information so they keep on coming back. You know, it's a no-brainer to me.
Mm.
Like, okay, we know what a point in brisket is. You and I do, and probably 95% of the butchers out there. But trimming them, making sure they're trimmed correctly for the customer, like, that's an art in itself. Like, you know, yeah. I've looked at it myself. I don't really trim it that hardly. I pretty much just take the big chunks of fat off, make sure it's pretty, try and even it up a bit.
Mm.
And that's how I do it.
Mm.
But you go to some of these competitions, like you're in a competition team.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah,
and I look at the amount of effort that goes into preparing the meat before in its raw state, and it looks absolutely beautiful. And you see the way it's presented, like parsley boy in the parsley trays. You know, Anthony there. You know, yeah. He puts all the parsley in, and then the meat's just gently and beautifully displayed.
It's the detail.
Yeah, the detail. It's like it's like setting a window up in the morning, isn't it? It's the same detail is in the presentation when you're preparing it for the judging.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, and I think you have to be passionate about it. And most of these guys who are coming in and asking for these really, really fantastic beef cuts, which are the cheapest cuts you can get, and like you said, traditionally they'd just be chucked into sausages and mince. And I know now for an Angus brisket, they're getting, you know, $30 a kilo.
Yep.
$30 a kilo for an Angus brisket. And that's straight out of the box, yep. Doug. Okay, so straight out of the box, $30 a kilo. Customers will say, oh yeah, I'll have that, and can you trim it up for me?
Yeah.
Not a problem.
Exactly.
Okay, so and tell them how to cook it. And these are the things that, look, there's a number of opportunity for butchers to use small goods and even small goods techniques to value add their businesses. Like, and you know yourself, Doug, that with the wholesale price of meat getting higher and higher, we're gonna have to look to new innovative ways to go forward. So we're very well placed as small individual butchers to make handcrafted, I like that word, small goods that are unique to their business. You can only buy that from that shop, and that's where they have to be. So my vision, this is just me personally, that every butcher shop will be doing some type of cooking to some degree. So as their business grows with demand, okay, that's what people are demanding. That's what they want. So we should be able to give it to them.
Definitely. The opportunities are great. Value adding has gone as far as it can go with a fresh product. I think, you know, we've pretty much exploited nearly everything, every type of meal or dish that you can, that a butcher can make. And now, like, cooking is becoming a lot more popular for those that can cook, where they've got the combi ovens in their stores, they've got the right food processing, like cooked food processing processes and licenses in place. But, you know, that's a big expense to get the combi in there to do a lot of that cooking. So I think, you know, the small goods side of it, like what we were talking about earlier, and just getting those little things right, making something that's unique to your business, as well as what we were just talking about then, low and slow, making sure that there's just some simple things to do that gives you that massive point of difference to the supermarket.
Oh, that's it.
I was in Coles on the weekend, and we do our grocery shopping there, the local Coles here, and I was looking at the brisket pieces there, and that's what they are, brisket pieces. They are a kilo, if that. They look like they're actually been moisture infused. Not very appetizing. There was a whole stack of them there. They're all different shapes and sizes. So you often see posts on social media and some of the smoking pages, and they're saying, bought this at Coles or bought this at the supermarket. Right? They say it's terrible. It didn't have flavor. It was, didn't know what to do with it. They cut it the wrong way. Whereas if the customer's going into the butcher shop, you know, they speak to the butcher understands what it is. It's so simple.
It's a point of difference, Doug. And I think to you sort of kind of make it sound simple, but it's not, okay? It's hard work, and it's like everything else in life. It's not, nothing's easy, okay? And when we say it's set out in the food safety plan, it is, but you still have to understand it.
Yeah.
You still have to follow the right rules. And I think that's where a lot of butchers not struggle, but they're busy, and they do have a hard time when I say to them, okay, look, it's that part of the cooking's in your food safety plan. What page is it on? What do I do? And I said, well, read it and you'll work it out. But so a lot of them, most of them are sort of coming around as far as being able to understand how the process works. A lot of them, the process is, there's not too many more steps to what they're already doing. It's just a matter of documenting stuff as well.
And it doesn't take long.
It doesn't. It's another part of the process. And when butchers say they're not busy, okay, well, then you need to diversify into something else.
You need to make yourself busy.
Yeah, and I think they're doing a good job. They're doing a great job. And I think, you know, you guys are doing a great job too, promoting all this stuff. So we sort of have to keep at it and get the butchers on board as far as the terminology and the cooking and the understanding of the products that people want. I think you said you were at Coles, and I was at Costco.
Yeah, isn't that a beast?
Well, the thing is too is that they're selling exactly what the people are asking for and what they're seeing on YouTube. That's the terminology they're using. If that's what they do, that's what we have to do as well.
I was up in Maitland, I think it's Green Hills up that way, a few months back, and I caught up with a butcher there, Steph Harris, and he's devoted a whole wall fridge. Like, it's not just one door, it's like three or four doors. And I think it's three quarters full of briskets, pork butts, butterfly legs, short ribs, everything that a smoker needs that they're looking for. And he says it ticks over every week. He sells a stack of it every week, and it's not just a little fridge, it's a proper, like what you see in a supermarket, one of those big wall fridges. He's got a big three or four door one there, and he sells, and then he's got the accompaniments to go with it, like all your condiments, all your charcoal, your pellets and whatever else you need. So, you know, it's the way to do it.
Yeah, one of the biggest questions I always get asked is how long will it take to cook this brisket? And I say to them, give them the same answer, how long is a piece of string? I said, every piece of meat will react a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's ready when the temperature gauge says it's ready.
Yep.
You know? And then I say to butchers, I said, well, if people are asking you how long does it take to cook that product, sell them a thermometer.
There you go. Yep.
I mean, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? You know what I mean? When it reaches 95 degrees internal, it's ready. You know what I mean? Rest it for an hour in an esky or a foam box or whatever you have to do, and rest it, all the trimmings off your brisket, turn it into tallow, and when you wrap your brisket, you can add the tallow to it, and that way you end up with a really juicy, tender brisket at the end of it once you've rested for a while. But that internal temperature is probably one of the most important things. So there's an opportunity there to be selling thermometers.
Yeah, it all helps.
You know, butchers say, oh, you can't make money out of meat. No worries, sell thermometers.
Well, the more...
Massive markup on them. Yeah,
well, you should be able to. But, you know, you look around at some of the butcher shops and they've got such a great range of products in there, especially the rubs.
Yes.
And the marinades. Yeah, but for the low and slowers, the rubs are brilliant.
Mm.
These low and slow classes that you guys are going to be starting over the next few months.
Yes.
So when are they actually going to start up, and how do they get involved? How do they contact you guys to get involved in them?
Okay, so I mean, we've got our Facebook page, which is the Granville Butchery page.
Okay,
so TAFE New South Wales, Granville Butchery. We have an email list, and if people can contact us on the Facebook page, and we'll put them on our email list. And when we have new courses coming up, we send it out to past students, mm-hmm. and that goes out to everyone, and then it just goes viral after that. Most people find us. I think we've got like nearly 2,000 followers on our Facebook page now. So when I post up classes that go on there, and I generally get a pretty good response out of it. It'll be July, August when we start those classes, which will be next semester.
Okay.
So right now we're building the courses. We've actually got a couple of smokers that we're practicing on.
Yep. The best part.
You have to practice, Doug.
You have to make sure
you get it right. Yeah.
Got to practice, mate.
Okay, so I invite you over for the next practice session, mate.
I'll be there.
And then once we've got it down pat, I think it's more about making sure that the guys who come to the class, hopefully a lot of butchers will come to these classes too. If not, it'll be the general public coming in, because the interest out there is huge.
Yeah, and that's where I think the butchers need to make that effort. At least send somebody from your shop to do these shops. It doesn't have to be the owner. It can be one of the young apprentices or one of the butchers that is already doing it at home, and I guarantee you there'd be nearly somebody in every shop would be doing it at home.
Yeah.
So just picking up those little one percenters that you guys know will make all the difference, and having that person in the shop to be able to give that information to the customer.
We pass on all the information to our apprentices in classes. I mean, those Frankfurts and cheese Kranskis that you tried the other day, Doug, they weren't made by us. They were made by the students.
Yeah.
Okay. So they were made by one of my colleagues, Martin Painter. His class is doing corn and cure. So during that corn and cure class, they're making Frankfurts and they're making hot dogs and they're doing cheese Kranskis and doing the corned beef, and they're making spec, and they're, you know what I mean? So these guys are getting a taste of it when they do come to the college, just as normal apprentices. So we try and incorporate the small goods into the classes as well.
Yep.
And it gets a lot of interest in the kids.
Yeah.
You get these kids interested, then they take that back to work. Oh, guess what we did today at TAFE? We made Frankfurts. And are they hard to do? Well, they're not hard to do. Doing other products isn't hard to do. So a lot of guys have got smoke ovens, Doug. Okay, and they do not utilize them at all.
Yeah.
You know, I went to one shop and he said, oh, you know anyone who wants to buy the smoke oven? And I said, don't you use it for anything? And he said to me, I used to, but it makes mess on the floor. That was a comment by a butcher. So he sold the oven and buys all his small goods in. And in the same breath, he's complaining to me that the prices of meat were so high that he can't make money out of meat anymore, but he's buying all these small goods in. He could be making them on the premises.
Sometimes we make silly decisions, snap decisions, without really thinking about it. But, you know, at the end of the day, that decision's made, and he'll just probably have to end up buying another smokehouse. Maybe buy something a little bit better, a little bit more, less manually operated. I think there's a lot of different ovens these days that you can get that everything's pre-programmed into them.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, most of the ovens these days are pre-programmed. They're not hard to run. Like I said, it's just a matter of having the will to be able to do it. And I think it's the next generation coming through that we have to train up.
A lot of this craft will be lost eventually, but the young ones coming through, the next generation are the ones that we need to educate and encourage to take up these things. It's like Rudy Montage up at Taree. I think we talked about him the other day. He's probably mid-70s, I think. Probably wouldn't be surprised if he is a little bit older. But his business has been up for sale for a few years now, and I think this year might be his last year. My sister buys a lot of products. She's got a winery up there at Kalungaluk, and she uses a lot of his stuff, his Kransky's and Frankfurt's and Lieberkass, all that at the winery. And yeah, she was afraid that he wasn't going to open this year, but luckily he did. He's back open again, but he's been there for a long time. But I reckon if I was 20 years younger, I'd be going back there, and I'd definitely have a crack at that, because it's one part of my learning experience through this industry I really enjoyed, even though it was for a really hard guy. I worked for a German smorgasbord down in DY many years ago, and he was tough as nails, and he abused the living daylights out of me, but I learned. I only made the same mistake once.
I quite often say that is that my original employer, he was a mongrel of a man. He was probably one of the best butchers I ever worked with in my life, and he taught me all the skill I know, but out of fear, Doug.
Yep.
Okay, so out of fear, I think that's got to be gone. But there's a lot to be said about the older guys and their knowledge.
Yeah.
That sometimes you just got to take a bit of initiative and learn from them, without them having to step you through it, because they won't step you through it.
No.
If you're interested, you got to be there to learn. And that's part of the learning these days, is that you have to be there to be able to learn. And a lot of these guys don't pass on that knowledge because they don't know how. But anyhow, we're addressing these things slowly but surely. And
yeah.
And I think me and the guys at the college, we're all like-minded.
Yep.
We all have a passion for the industry. And if that's the way the industry's going, that's the way we'll go as well.
Yeah, definitely. Now, it's great to know that the college is supporting what you do as a team, and allow you to do things like the low and slow. And then it's not outside of TAFE hours too, isn't it? It's outside of your normal working hours as well. So you've got your day-to-day sort of routines with the apprentices, and then the night classes as well. So it's great to see that sort of thing happening for industry, and I think a lot more butchers as well as consumers should get on board with that and learn a little bit more. You know, like it's those 1%ers that make the difference.
Oh, for sure, mate, for sure. Like I said, we're there at the college, and the college is a centre of excellence, and it's purpose built for the meat industry, Doug. And this is something that butchers really need to understand, is that me and the guys are there to be used and abused. And I say that loosely. Okay, so
okay.
And what I mean by that is that we get a lot of industry people ringing us up, okay. And if we don't know the answer, we'll find out for you. So if there's a training need, we can help you.
Yep.
Okay. So we do a lot of work with a lot of the spice companies out there. So we do a lot of R&D work with these guys as well. So we're not knowledgeable because we work for TAFE. We're knowledgeable because we're passionate about the industry, and we ask why.
Oh, that's great, mate.
What we don't know, we find out.
Exactly the same this end too, mate.
100%.
Well, I bet you Maddie's sort of looking to get you back on the counter again. There's probably a few customers that want to speak to you about a brisket or two. So, look, mate, really appreciate your time today. Take care of yourself, and I hope to see you in the next few weeks.
No, thank you very much, Doug, for the opportunity, and thanks to the Australian Butchers Guild for doing this podcast. I reckon it's fantastic, and let it hope it keeps going on and on and on and on.
Cheers, buddy.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Well, folks, that's a wrap for today's episode. I hope you found some of Andrew's info useful. And don't forget, those courses will be valuable for somebody in your team, in your business, to go and attend. So don't forget, you can contact us for more information at butchers@mla.com.au, and I can put you in touch with the Granville TAFE guys. Thanks for listening, and stay well.